It's new for us to see you part of a band rather than just fronting a big spectacular.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you decide to do it?
It gives me a new insight into washing habits.
You all share the same shower, do you?
No.
That's not good.
What are you trying to do?
Hello and welcome to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. It's 1988 and you're David Bowie, and it's with a sense of alarm, frustration, that you realise that since your pact with the Devil of Dance back in 1983, something's gone a bit wrong. Yes, you've become very rich, you've become a very, very famous pop personality, and you have a great mullet, but you have two terrible albums in your wake. What to do next? You're in danger of losing that credibility that you so carefully built up in the 1970s. Time to record with Bryan Adams' backing band? Time to, I don't know, write a musical? No, it's time for Tin Machine! That's right, it was Tin Machine time. I remember buying Tin Machine in 1988 when I was about 14, or 89, whenever it came out, I think it was around then, and being a bit amazed because up to that point I'd really just been familiar with David Bowie's greatest hits. And here I found this bearded Bowie, who's looking for all the world like a provincial middle manager, playing brash, aggressive rock and roll. It was thrilling and alienating in equal measure. And I remember at the time, the media reception was actually one of curiosity, initially fairly positive. Ah, what's he gone and done? Dave's gone metal! But it fit in with the stereotype, paradoxically, of that old chestnut, the chameleon of pop, changing his colours yet again, and coming up with something new, just to baffle and confound us. Ah, Dave. So, here he was, teaming up with the avant-garde guitarist Reeves Gabrels and the rumbustious rhythm section of Hunt and Tony Sales, who had played on Iggy's The Idiot and Lust for Life albums back in the late 70s. And Bowie himself had come up with the wheeze of retreating to this sort of rock frat boy club, just being one of the lads, determinedly just the singer of a band of steely, skronky, hardcore metal. Well, that was the plan. And commendable a plan it was. As we know, it didn't quite pan out that way. Despite a handful of really good tunes spread across the two LPs Tin Machine released in their lifetime, the project ultimately fell down in 1992, amidst rumours of personal differences within the band, and that was it. But in hindsight, as my guest Charlotte Hadley and I spend the best part of the next hour chewing over, it served as a massive boot up the Bowie backside, a reinvigorating experience that paved the way for a considerably more exciting, dynamic and experimental decade of music to come. So now, please join Charlotte and myself as we meander in and around all things Tin Machine, taking in just about everything on the way from falling in and out of love with Paul McCartney, writer's block, guitar histrionics, the man who sold the world, and oh, much, much more. I hope you enjoy this talk, and here we are.
Got a new guitar teacher. Yeah, because I haven't been playing guitar for my own personal fun satisfaction. But we got talking about Reeves Gabrels because I've been listening to a lot of Tin Machine as research. And we were talking a lot about just Bowie's various guitar players. And he mentioned The Man Who Sold the World. He was like, you should listen to that record because the way that Tony Visconti mixed Mick Ronson's guitar is really unique. It's got a really specific sound that at that time no one else was mixing records like that. So with that in mind, I will go back to that record because that was... I love that record, The Man Who Sold the World. Actually, I just saw an interview with, like a Tin Machine interview on YouTube. And Bowie's talking about how he was in the studio. He said, the thing with Mick Ronson is that I actually had to sing him the guitar parts.
Yes.
And I was thinking, is that true?
I don't think that's true. I also heard that quote.
Yeah.
And I just thought, that can't be true. I mean, Ronson did so much. But I think in that interview, he does go on to be like, well, actually, no, I mean, Mick did write a lot of The Man Who Sold the World, so he gives him that.
Yeah.
But maybe he's talking more about the Ziggy days, because then he's a bit disparaging. Yeah. He said, look, in the interview, it was like, well, why did you dump that band? And he's like, well, they'd have been happy playing Jeff Beck covers till Kingdom Come, really, whereas I wanted to go and do something else.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, I think so.
Like this.
You're right. I think he probably had way more freedom on The Man Who Sold the World. Because by the time we get to Ziggy Stardust, he's in his, like, dictatorship full-on mode, which is interesting because if we relate it to Tin Machine, that would have been first band properly. Well, actually, the last band that he'd had.
Pretty much, wasn't it?
Between Ziggy Stardust and Tin Machine. And the whole idea for Tin Machine was that he wanted to get... I think by the time we got to the 80s, it was so, like, overblown and sort of victim of his own success that he had all these sort of hangers-on, and I think Reeves Gabrella called them checkbook musicians. So just, like, very expensive session players. Yes men, basically. Yeah. So the appeal of Tin Machine was, you know, that they... were very brutally honest and were like, well, David, the last three albums you've done have been shit.
Yeah.
There's one interview where it's painful, actually, because they are so relentlessly giving him grief, almost like making a point of it. I was like, we are not your yes men. We're here to tell you that.
Right, right.
You know, you've been on the wrong path and now we're going to set you straight. The Glass Spider tour was like the... final nail in the coffin, and it's almost like that was the end of Bowie as we knew him. And I think he must have felt, I think his whole sort of world had fallen apart, and he was going through all sorts of like personal crises, as well as, you know, having this universally panned album.
What sort of personal crises was he having at that time?
Well, he was, you know, reaching 40.
Well, he hit 40 in the dreaded 87.
Age. Yeah, well, I was looking at the first Tin Machine record, he was 41. And in my mind...
He's younger than me.
I know, in my mind, I was like, oh, sexy dad, you know, era. Sexy bearded dad era. And I was like, he's 2 years older than me.
That's not a sexy bearded dad.
Really scary.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think he was single, or he was having this relationship with the dancer from the Glass Spider tour. But kind of... she was much younger than him.
Oh, that was Melissa Hurley, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was sort of reading this book where Carlos Alomar was concerned about him. And I think the burdens and the pressure of that tour, you know, having to stick with a tour that you know isn't working. And he said that every day there were problems that he had to deal with. And when I think they burnt the spider at the end of the tour.
Ceremoniously.
Yeah, it was like a real cathartic moment for him. And to, you can imagine going from the Serious Moonlight tour, which was just loved and huge success, to then going to the opposite end of the spectrum and having, you know, people saying that was it, it was over, must have been really difficult. And I think he probably ended up thinking, how the hell did I get here? He was in a place that he was burned, you know, he wanted that success so badly for Let's Dance, and then he got it, and he just didn't know how to function. He didn't know how to write properly. He didn't know. He sort of lost perspective and allowed his music to be produced, and he was doing cover versions. I think he did that terrible God Only Knows cover
version. On Tonight, yeah.
It's just so appalling. And you think, how... It really fascinates me how people can lose their perspective in such an extreme way. How can you not know that that's terrible? It's almost like he just didn't care. He wasn't invested. It was almost like he got what he wanted.
Well, he stopped being at that cutting edge, arguably, say, around the time of Let's Dance. And I've mentioned this in other podcasts as well, but that was around the time that Prince really started emerging.
Right.
And in many ways, you could see that Prince sort of took over from where Bowie was in terms of being like this absolute one-man, self-reinventing avant-garde pop. And Bowie, after Let's Dance, I mean... it had been in his mind to make a big smasheroo, which he did. But then where'd you go? Like you say, Tonight, Never Let Me Down. I mean, Tonight, I think, really is the absolute pits.
Tonight's terrible.
It's really bad.
Never Let Me Down has a few... Well, when I started to get into David Bowie when I was like 13 or 14, I listened to Never Let Me Down quite a lot, actually. I think songs like Day In, Day Out and the title track.
I thought it was really good.
Yeah, it's a sweet song. But it's, you know, it's in hindsight, it suffers from the production is really dated. As you get to the end of the 80s, there's Guns N' Roses, Bon Jovi, Stadium Rock becoming huge. Mm. But then there's this emerging sort of alternative rock scene, like Dinosaur Jr., Sonic Youth and the Pixies, who weren't top 20 artists, they weren't mainstream, but they were brewing. Mm. And he was obviously sort of, you know, coming, you know, you can't think of more different records than Tonight, Never Let Me Down, and then you listen to what was actually happening at the time. So he was in danger of becoming a stadium rock sort of Rod Stewart. Basically, he needed to destroy it, which is what Tin Machine was. It was his vehicle to burn down this sort of like massive palace that he'd built for himself of just financial mainstream success.
I think what's interesting is also if we look at that period, like you say, a lot of these bands like the Pixies, Sonic Youth, sort of bubbling in what was still then the outer margins.
Yeah.
You know, they were on the peripheries of mainstream music scene. But in that same year, in 88, 89, you suddenly had all these dinosaurs from the 60s and 70s kind of coming back with new, like a new maturity. I mean, I'm thinking of the Stones with Steel Wheels, Lou Reed with New York, Dylan with Oh Mercy, Paul McCartney with Flowers in the Dirt.
Right, right.
They all seemed to up their game in 89 and sort of establish themselves in this new kind of strata of elder statesmen.
Mm.
And implicit in that was the message they weren't going to be any more changes of direction, there wasn't going to be any radical experimentation, at least not mainstream. I mean, McCartney did a lot of experimental stuff on the side. And Bowie seemed to buck the trend with that.
Mm.
So, like you say, he was doing these incredibly overproduced albums. He could have just gone straight to the greatest hits, which he actually did do in 91. But he could have just then put out another album. In fact, I found a quote earlier where he said, "I'd have been quite happy going off and making another solo album." Mm. So that's an interesting thought. If he hadn't bumped into Reeves and if he hadn't kind of gone in that direction, he could well have just churned out another.
Well, he had a session, I think he had a recording session with, it's either Bon Jovi's producer or Bryan Adams or something like that, with members of, Bryan Adams' band, sort of lined up, and he just felt completely uninspired. I think he, at that point, he knows that he's got a massive problem. But that's the sort of, once you reach that upper echelon of like sort of, what do they call, legacy artists,
right, exactly.
That's who you are aligned with, and suddenly you're surrounded by people who think it's a good idea for you to go into studio with Bryan Adams' band.
I mean, that really gave me pause for thought, was that if Tin Machine hadn't happened, what would have been that album? I think, I mean, I never knew this about Bryan Adams' band, but that's a sort of really horrible thought. But it could well have been the case.
Yeah.
Because he said as well in some interview around that time, I had a load of ideas which sort of got sublimated into Tin Machine and then turned into something totally differently.
Yeah.
But it's kind of intriguing, really, which direction this could have gone into.
Well, I mean,
he was
clearly
pissed off with the Glass Spider thing. But would he have just tried to do another, you know, plodding...
It also sort of goes to show how easily influenced he is by the people he's in a room with. And I think some people are like that. You know, if you could record a song anywhere in the world in completely different styles, and every style you'd love, because in that moment in the studio, with the people you choose to be with, everyone's loving it. And so you're loving it. But then I feel with Bowie that he's so influenced by everyone that he has around him that it's really crucial that he chooses the right people, which he is, you know, renowned for being so impeccable with his taste of the musicians and producers. Nile Rodgers is a completely inspired choice for Let's Dance, but then somehow it all goes awry on those two. Two albums out of
several. Well, Nile Rodgers didn't do Tonight, did he?
No.
He wasn't involved. Hugh Padgham, who was then the really, you know, hotshot guy, the Police and everything like that, was brought in.
Yeah.
But I think it was just one of those cases where no one really wanted to take the credit for it in the end.
Right.
It was a real mishmash. There was no kind of overall feel
or
unity to it.
And I feel like he's very open to collaborative ideas and suggestions. So it is crucial for him to be in the room with the right people, or else he could end up tonight on your hands.
So what happened was that around the time that the Glass Spider tour ended, apparently it was the tour's publicist who handed Bowie a cassette of her husband, Oscar Brell's.
Yeah.
And Bowie heard that. And then they did a ballet of...
Yeah.
At the ICA in London.
Yeah, with La La La, that Human Steps. Right, yeah. And they did... So that was the first thing that him and Reeves Gabrel did together. It was a version, an updated version of Look Back in Anger. And then he did that performance, which is on YouTube. And it's really interesting because it's going back to a sort of theatrical stage setting. Mm. He's doing this sort of interpretive dance with the woman from the La 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 Human Steps. And he looks unbelievable. She's the woman who was in the Fame, the re-release of the Fame video.
That was his then-girlfriend, wasn't it?
I don't know.
Apparently she was in that Fame video, sort of like flailing around. And
Yeah.
I think it was.
Yeah, and they've got this that super cool dance routine together. And it's really interesting because it's the total opposite of the Glass Spider tour, which is what most people would have, the last thing they would have seen. And it's like a real drum machine heavy version of Look Back in Anger. And that was their bond, really, was that Reeves Gabrel was an art school music nerd, a bit of a Brian Eno, a bit of a professor. And they didn't really... Reeves Gabrel was saying that, you know, they were hanging out on the Glass Spider tour because his wife was doing press. And he never told Bowie that he was a musician. They would just sit around and talk about art. And
it was just so-and-so's husband is...
Yeah, he was just hanging around. They were just having cerebral chats about all sorts of stuff, but never music.
Probably weren't doing Pete and Dud imitations.
Yeah, exactly. I think they would watch TV with the sound down and make up their own.
God, such a chapester.
God. Such a, what a geezer.
When I remember reading about those times when he was talking about the sessions for Heroes and Low, I love the fact that then he meets another egghead.
Yeah.
20 years later.
Yeah, totally. The eggheads are really good for him.
He does need an egghead, doesn't he?
He definitely needs this
deep seated sense of insecurity, you know, like an autodidact, like he's taught himself.
That's what I mean. It's like I feel like he can be pulled into directions that aren't totally right for him, unless he's got a solid side man in the form of Eno.
Okay,
he
should do this.
Yeah, or yeah, exactly. It's like you're right. He's almost like he lacks the confidence to just fully embrace the pretension and that the arty side of himself. I mean, that's the interesting thing with Tin Machine, because, you know, he does this collaborative thing with Reeves Gabrel, which is like a return to his theatrical arty past. But then he brings in Hunt and Tony Sales, who are loud, crazy American rock dudes who kind of bring the primal element to it. Whereas I think Reeves Gabrel and Bowie together would have made really interesting sort of experimental rock music, but there was some balls that the Sales Brothers brought to the party.
Of course, the Sales Brothers, they'd been on Iggy Pop's album Idiot. I mean, Hunt Sales, the drummer, was the famously like dun 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 for Lust for Life.
Yeah,
and then I believe that him and Reeves were slowly coming towards the idea of doing something together, and that was great. But then who do they need? And they thought of a few different people.
Mm.
But then Bowie thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it properly. And so he's remembering that time.
Yeah.
He brings in the Sales Brothers. Now, we'll talk more about them in a bit. But I think what they brought, certainly from what I've seen in interviews, was a real sense of don't take it so seriously.
Yeah.
Knock out the arty bullshit. I mean, like you said, they come from a very kind of rock blues background.
Yeah.
And that's not really something that he'd been for a while.
Yeah. And they were quite... confrontational in the way that they were like, well, you're David Bowie, who gives a fuck?
Yeah.
And he obviously liked that, whereas I think they had a few issues with Reeves Gabrel. Like, I think he found them quite
abrasive.
Yeah. And, you know, a really sort of macho squaring off of the first sort of week they spent together recording, where they were like pushing him and poking him and a bit, you know, who the fuck are you?
Mm.
And, you know, I think suddenly Bowie's confronted with personalities as big as his, And, you know, that's what he wanted. He wanted a democratic band where everyone has equal rights, equal speaking time. They were singing their own songs. And you see in interviews, you know, they're talking over him, they're interrupting him, and it's, you can almost sense the frustration and how hard it would have been for him to take the back seat after all this time of being the only person in interviews and press shots, and suddenly you're sharing that with guys who are like publicly taking the piss out of you.
But like you say, he must have loved that. He must have really loved that.
I think he probably loved it to start with.
I mean, that was definitely a big part of it. Was,
yeah,
I don't want to be David Bowie in the backing, but I want to be just part of the gang. It was fading into anonymity. And I know the beard has a sort of special significance for you.
Yeah. Well, it became a bit of a divorcees club where they were all divorced, and they
wasn't
were all
that
like
a potential name at one point, something like the
something like that.
Club.
Well, yeah.
Thank God. I mean, that's such a terrible.
Yeah. You know. But it, you know, that sort of blokes in their early 40s and feeling a bit lost, but they're all clean. They've been through rehab and divorced and
the midlife crisis.
The midlife crisis, yeah. Totally. Younger girlfriends, and it was kind of, it was just so textbook. But it was a bit, it was a Bowie that, up to that point, no one had really seen that blokey Bowie, like with a bunch of blokes in the band wisecracking, and you know, he becomes a bit of a diamond geezer.
Oh yeah,
and you can see that on stage as well—the way he's like introducing the band, and you know, it's all like wisecracks. And I never really felt comfortable with that Bowie. You know, sometimes he would turn that on in interviews, like the TFI Friday. I don't know if you remember that. He goes on these, but he's just like so effervescent and happy, and just like nothing is.
I remember that one.
Nothing is serious, and suddenly it's like a totally different side to him, which is probably. Maybe that was closer to the real him.
Well, it's a classic deflection strategy, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe.
How to avoid being asked anything remotely searching or piercing but deflect it with this.
But if anything, the Tim Machine era was the most confronting interviews because he was getting a public roasting. Mm. And even in there was a interview, I think it was Q Magazine or something, and they do the album playback. And the journalist talks about how nervous and stressed he is.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, the interview is basically saying, well, basically, you've just done a load of rubbish, haven't you? And so he's constantly having to apologise and explain himself, which must have been so hard. I mean, there's no way I'd be able to do that. And then you're with a band of people who are also rubbing salt in the wounds, saying, well, you know, the interviewer was saying, what did you think of his,
yes,
and right in front of him they're saying,
what do you think of the glass spider tour?
Terrible.
Well, I think it was Hunt Sales that was going, hey, I'm not going to sit here and say it was good, but it's really bad. I mean, you're right, this is such an interesting thing to just imagine, that this almost very masochistic whipping of himself, you know, almost like putting himself through this experience after this atoning for Glass Spider, Tonight, all the rest of it. Right, I'm going to hang out with this bunch of, you know, heavy, juicy rock guys. I'm going to let them kick the shit out of me in interviews.
But how brave is that? I mean, you can't imagine Paul McCartney. I think, Nigel Godrich was saying when he produced that record, he was like, he had to sack his band because it was just full of yes men.
Yeah.
And to get him to do anything remotely out of his comfort zone or different was a real challenge. But, you know, you break down that the ego that inevitably you're going to have if you're Paul McCartney or David Bowie. And I think it's very brave of him to put himself through that.
Yeah, I don't think any other artist of that standing would have had the balls to really do that, and especially at that point in their career. You mentioned McCartney, and I was reading about the recording for Press to Play in 1986, probably the worst album in McCartney's solo career. I think it was Eric Stewart that was...
I've had an evening with your sister listening to Press to Play.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but that was another...
What was wrong?
Well, the funny thing is, before I got into Bowie...
I vaguely actually remember her saying this.
Hugely into Paul McCartney. He was like my first... McCartney was my first love in a dad-like way.
Before you fell for Bowie, you were going out with Paul McCartney.
I was going out with Paul McCartney, and I had
when
this,
did
like...
you get together with Paul McCartney? What was he doing when you got together?
Well, huge Beatles thing going on all throughout my childhood. And then, I mean, really, it was Flowers in the Dirt, which was just a classic Parent in the Car album. And I really love that record. And I did have Press to Play. And I was into like Wings and his solo stuff as well. And yeah, I listened to Press to Play non-stop. And I realise it's not a good record. But it's got its moments. It's got its moments.
But do you know the Bowie connection with that record?
No.
Carlos Alomar.
No way.
He's on it because at that point, McCartney was sending out SOSs to everyone.
That's amazing.
And in some McCartney biography I read, they interview Alomar. And it's so funny because he's this, like, you know, New York Hispanic dude. And he went down to stay with the McCartneys in Sussex. And he said it was great, you know, he would cut a few tracks on McCartney, then they'd go off to the pub and have a few beers and then come back and Linda would have cooked dinner and it was all very homely. And Stella or Mary McCartney would call for Mr. Alomar in the morning.
Aww.
He loved it. But yeah,
amazing.
I don't know what actually made it onto the final cut, because famously that album just took forever to make. I mean, I was reminded of this because you were saying how difficult it is for producers to work with these big names. I think it was Eric Stewart and again, Hugh Padgham. And Eric Stewart was quite bitter and just saying, you know, this album's a nightmare. McCartney wasn't really there. He wasn't really that engaged with it. He was coming in with sketches of tunes.
Yeah.
Eric Stewart would have to be like, well, come on, you know, a bit more.
Yeah.
And then a few points, McCartney actually did get quite nasty and said, look, when was the last time you wrote a number one record?
Yeah.
And he was just like, well, forget it. And I think he just left the sessions.
Yes. I can imagine that being the case. And I think, you know, it must be very hard to accept that your output's not very good. And when, you know, the last thing you want, when you know something's not very good, is for someone to say that to you. And you can be incredibly defensive and have a really unpleasant response. And then, you know, I'm talking from personal experience. when someone says, oh, I'm not so sure about that song, it needs a bit more work, and you know it, but your instant reaction is, yeah, fuck you.
Yeah.
But then 10 minutes later, you're like, you're right. You know it. You know it. And I think Bowie knew that he was lost. And probably going through writer's block, it's a creative block, which, you know, fair enough. He'd done how many records beforehand? 10, 15? Of, like, amazing output. Of course you're going to get to a point where you know, it stops. It's just that he did it in such spectacular way. It was such a ridiculous, overblown way where it all crashed and burned. And I'm quite forgiving of this whole period, because I can sort of relate to that feeling of, like, just creative when the well has dried up. It's incredibly hard to pick it back up.
So have you been through something like this?
I am putting myself in line with David Bowie.
No, I mean, generally interesting.
I went through a period of horrible creative block in the middle of this record, and it was because I wrote a whole record and recorded it, and then several things, like a domino effect, went wrong. And when I revisited it, I realized I had to rewrite half of it. Someone said to me, you've got half a good record, which was the last thing I wanted to hear. And so I agreed. And so I went off and thought, right, I'm going to write more songs, and I just couldn't. And so that's why I brought in collaborators. So half of my record are co-writes. I met Michael Lovett from Nazca Lines, and he came in and he really saved me from, like, a horrible period. And it was weird when, you know, that happens to you. You don't ever expect that.
Had that not really happened on that scale before?
It's always, you know, the initial period is hard. And because I tour a lot, you never really get into a rhythm. So if I've been away for like a month or two and I come back to write, it's a nightmare the first week. And then you get into this rhythm and suddenly everything's easy. And I think when you're out of that rhythm, it feels like you're never going to find it. It's like being in love with someone. Like when you're single, you have periods where you're like, I'm just never going to be with anyone ever. I can't imagine it. And I think when you dry up creatively, you just think, this is it. I'm never going to write a song.
Yeah.
And it's a real, it infiltrates every area of your life. And I think, you know, maybe for Bowie, it just seemed like he was at that period where just achieved everything that you could have hoped to achieve.
I mean, the last big thing he wanted to do was become a rich pop star. Partly due to his terrible...
He'd been broke for so long.
Exactly. And his deal with his former manager.
Yeah.
And then he really needed to make money. But then here we are with an album which was determinedly the antithesis of everything his record label wanted.
Yeah.
So I think in the story, we've got to the point where we're with Reeves Gabrels, the Sales Brothers have come on board.
Yeah.
They start jamming.
Yeah.
And knocking down tunes. And Bowie is inspired again. He's feeling it's coming back together for him.
Yes. Yeah. And I think they interrupted his way that usually write. I think Bowie always, for me personally, delivered better music when he demoed. Mm. So Lodger wasn't that musically satisfying for me. They were just sketches. And I think Low, to a certain extent, were sort of sketches as well. Developed a bit further in the studio with Brian Eno. But then Scary Monsters was a very well thought out, prepared, demoed record. It was
a very well produced album.
Yes.
Scary Monsters.
Yeah, and for me, that's my favourite. So well crafted, put together, and where the lyrics were prepared. Whereas with Tin Machine, the whole ethos was we're one takes, going to play live in the studio, we're not going to do any overdubs or... not going to use... I think they really reacted against drum machines, the whole dance scene that was happening at the time. They wanted to go back to quite an old-fashioned, a band playing live in a studio all together. Contrast that with the way he recorded Berlin period, where you would have all these different session musicians would come in and they'd just cut it all up.
Well, I was going to say the irony of one of the pioneers of electronic music in the pop mainstream now suddenly turning his back on all that and being very... clear and emphatic, right? None of that. This is just pure, And to go back to that point again about 1989, that's what Lou Reed was doing.
Right.
Say for New York.
Right, right.
He even put it on the album notes, just two guitars, bass and drums. That's all you need.
I think that's the most important thing about Tin Machine, because the songs, there are a handful of good songs, but it's not so much about that. It was about the whole process that he obviously needed to strip it all back down to, a four-piece band. And I think we were talking, when we were talking about Heroes, the way that he was inspired by Iggy Pop, obviously because the Sales Brothers are there, there's a big, the shadow of Iggy Pop is looms large. And I think a lot of the songs on Tin Machine 1, you can imagine Iggy Pop singing. And I think they forced him to not rewrite his lyrics. So the lyrics are they're quite crude. He sort of has a bit of a social conscience, and he's talking about things in a slight embarrassing way.
The social conscience comes out, and at times it is a bit cringy. It is a bit cringy. Crack City, Under the God, drugs, racism, And I think that's part of the reason people have a problem with this album, is that he doesn't have that sort of knowingness.
Well, they wouldn't let him
refine.
Yeah. They wouldn't let him change the lyrics. So it was very much whatever comes out. And I think Iggy Pop does it in such a fucked up poetic way.
Right, well, Iggy Pop's way more poetic than they're just a bunch of nasty
buttholes
for brains or whatever. It's just really, some of the lyrics are really, really.
And you can see how he would obviously go back and change that. And I think he said that he would never be so, he would never wear his heart on his sleeve in that way. And he never has before or after. I mean, it's very much a Tin Machine thing. You're never going to hear him singing those lyrics again. And that was very much the Sales Brothers...
one-take philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not allowed to rewrite. You're not allowed to over-intellectualize. One takes, not that many overdubs, really. And it was all about this is a live experience. So they're not demoed. And in fact, Reeves Gabrel said the album is the demo. And, the problem with Tin Machine for me is that they just don't have... tunes. They're there's some really good ideas and some of the songs I really love, but they're not they're just not fleshed out. They're like sketches, really.
Exactly. I mean, that to me, Tin Machine is a load of riffs sort of hammered together, and it's like a lot of little things pieced together. There are some great songs there.
Yeah, there are.
Which, and again, kind of in my fantasy what if universe, say if he got back with Visconti at that point, or if something happened and he got that bunch of songs, it could have been something really, really exciting and really thrilling. But what would be your pick of the album? I mean, what are the songs that really do it for you?
I really loved Amazing.
I was going to say, that one is a fantastic tune.
Really love that song. And I think for all of Reeves Gabrels' screeching dissonance... he's very similar to Fripp. He has this very melodic guitar.
Well, the Hendrix comparisons are always made, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think Bowie's references were all Hendrix. In fact, Reeves Gabrel said it was like, what did we say, Pinstripes and Purple Haze?
what a great quote.
Yeah.
Pinstripes and Purple Haze.
And it was Purple Haze, Hendrix, Cream, Led Zeppelin. So like big, stodgy, blokey rock, but put through this like garage, hardcore filter. So they wanted to be abrasive and loud, but it's rooted in the sort of R&B traditional rock. So it's kind of, you have moments of it where it's just a bit leaden.
But then you get these tracks like Amazing.
Yeah.
Which is a love song.
Yeah.
And it has this sort of very brusque tenderness to it. But I love that sort of little rhythm guitar lick that runs all the way through.
And yeah.
To me, there it all kind of comes together. No one element dominates.
Yeah.
Which is a problem I have with some of the Tin Shin stuff, where especially with the drummer, Hunt Sales, a lot of tracks seem to sort of like trail into like a clatter of mental drumming.
Yeah, but the thing is, when you see them live, his drumming, there are some live stuff I've seen that is unbelievable. And when they're going for it, I mean, they are bloody brilliant. It's a live experience, really. I don't know, what's the live film called?
Oy vey, baby.
Right, yeah. I mean, that is actually quite bad. But there's other stuff.
I mean, Googling it, I feel I'm the one person in the world that actually likes that album, because I remember when I moved away from London in 2000, God, when was it, 2002, 2003, I just took a few CDs with me, and that was one I took with me. And that's the first time I heard, for example, If There Is Something, the Roxy Music song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which I do the amazing version of. And then they do the I think 12-minute version of Heaven's in Here, which again I really liked.
And yes.
I know this goes totally against the grain of the critical consensus, but he's throwing in I'm a King Bee and stuff like that into there. It's rather like you know, Live at Leeds by The Who, where they do those long 10-minute versions of
Summertime
Blues of My Generation, and he just, you know, and it just evolves and snakes all over the place. I don't think that was that bad an album. I mean, the title was awful though.
No, I think it's just like you have some good songs and then you have the two... everyone gets a song to sing. Mm. So the Hunt Sales song...
Like the Ringo song.
It is so bad.
Stateside.
Stateside is sorry. And then Tony Sales sings a cover of Go Now.
Oh, yes.
Since You Gotta Go. Yeah. And it's bad. And I just can't quite understand why they would do this like anarchic... guitar, like mental, almost like his guitar playing is a throwback to Scary Monsters for me.
Right.
And there are some lodgery moments in there, but then
Fripp, in other words.
Yeah. And then they chuck in this like Americana sort of classics, and I'm like, why would you do that?
Well, Stateside to me is just this dreary, lumpen,
it's really bad,
plodding mess.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody's got a good word for that song quite understandable.
Yeah, and it just makes me laugh because like nobody wants to see Hunt or Tony Sales, and Reeves Gabrel gets to sing a song.
What did he sing?
I can't remember. It's a cover.
Right.
It's towards the end, and nobody wants to see that.
But wasn't that underlining the democracy of the band, given the fact that their lead singer was obviously David Bowie?
Yeah.
All these gestures and statements and decisions to allow everyone else to sing was a misguided attempt at underlining the fact that the singer Dave wasn't that big a deal.
This
is a band democracy, and so that would be
It was like a forced camaraderie that just in the end couldn't sustain itself.
Do you remember seeing them on Wogan?
I saw that. I didn't see it at the time, but I saw it on YouTube.
So you've got a talented lad here. His name's David.
Oh, that's the thing. I kind of felt like there's that other interview with Paulie Yates on YouTube, I think, for the Tube. And he's difficult. He's tricky. And he just can't be bothered to sort of engage. And there's a slight element of that sort of laddish blokes in a band. And just, I don't know, it didn't...
Again, it's repudiation. It's repudiation of the theatrical glass spider. It's trying to trash his commonly held perception of being this incredibly esoteric, artistic person.
Yeah.
And when you read a lot of those interviews now, like we've both been reading these interviews ahead of this conversation, and what struck me, as well as you, years before Damon Albarn was doing it in Blur, but that really kind of like boneheaded philistinism.
I think in
that Q interview, he makes some really bizarre gags. He said, some guy just came up in the street and said, do you like Pussycat? But my name's not Cat. And it's just, you know that somewhere inside him, he was cringing at this.
Mm.
But yet again, it was this role he wants to play, just being like this, you know, down with the lads
kind of character.
And again, so fascinating to think in 20 years of a career that it come to this stage where he just so desperately wants to erase it all. He wants to just to push all that away.
Yeah.
So aggressively.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I mean, some of it's quite uncomfortable to watch, actually.
the interviews or music.
Yeah, the interviews. As a Bowie fan, you... Well, I sort of feel like it's uncomfortable and it's awkward.
Do you feel what? Because he's not... Because he's so clearly adopting a persona?
Well, he's adopting a persona, but at the same time, you can see... I feel for him sort of being relegated.
Okay, that's... I take your point. Having said that, though, in every interview that I've read from the time, about that time, he's generally very, very positive about it. I mean, even 4 or 5 years hence, he looks back at that time with a degree of fondness. I mean, he keeps coming back to this one point, was I needed that kick up the arse. I needed that kick up the pants.
Yeah.
Cringe-worthy as it was, and as much as he acknowledges that the records maybe weren't up to certain standards, he will always credit that period as being the very necessary intervention into a career which was perilously close to going off the rails.
And there are other songs, actually. Let me just have a look.
I really like Heaven's in Here, for example. apart from the ending, which I think is just a bit previous.
Well, they all end in very strange ways.
Not all of them. I mean, I think, let's take this first album. And in that album, I would say Heaven's in Here, Amazing, Bus Stop. What else do we have?
I'm not sure about Bus Stop.
Oh, come on, Bus Stop's brilliant.
Heaven's in Here, I've got to say, when I got the record, it was just after when he did The Lord's Prayer for the Freddie Mercury tribute. So that was the first time I saw him on TV, and then I went to the library and I got Space Oddity. But I listened to Tin Machine pretty quickly. You know, there's so many records to discover, and I had no idea of the chronological order of it all.
But seriously, The Lord's Prayer at Freddie Mercury made that much of an impression on you?
Yeah, really? I was obsessed. And he did the song with, he did Under Pressure with Annie Lennox, and he had that green suit.
The green suit, the lime green
and
suit.
It blew my mind.
And he had the strictly gelled.
Yeah. It was, the difference between being a sort of Paul McCartney dad fan and being suddenly realising David Bowie existed was very different. And
Did you dump Paul around that time?
I dumped Paul.
Yeah.
I wanted Paul to be my dad, and I wanted David Bowie to be my boyfriend.
That'd be quite a peachy setup, wouldn't it? Imagine.
It would be amazing.
I'm just going out now, Dad. Hey, all right, what time are we coming back? I'm meeting David. I don't want you meeting him. You dumped Paul at a good time, because you dumped him around the time of Off the Ground, which was...
That was bad.
I mean, we were talking about how bad Press Play was, but Off the Ground really was.
That was bad.
Really bad. So that was a good time to meet David.
He was gone. But then the strange thing is that I was listening to Tin Machine on the way to school, and I loved that record. In hindsight, I only love a few of the songs, but Heaven's in Here was, I love that song. And the guitar really, it was just before I joined my first band. I joined my first band when I was like 15, but the guitar playing on that record was really influential. It's quite polarizing, Rives Gabrel. Some people absolutely hate him, but I find it quite fascinating, his guitar playing.
Was that the first guitar player you heard that really was out of the left field?
Or had he been
into sort of quite esoteric players before that?
It would have been the craziest. I mean, I was sort of exploring Robert Fripp at the same time.
Right.
With Bowie's older stuff. I mean, I got into it at a strange time because there was Tin Machine, but then it was shortly followed by Black Tie White Noise. Mm. And then Britpop was happening when I was 16. So you had Bowie on the front cover of Men to Make It with Brett Anderson, and
so he was sort of All This Will Be Yours.
Yeah, so he was sort of going through that renaissance, and then Buddha of Suburbia, which I think we talked about before, that was on TV, and I love that soundtrack. So it was, I was sort of getting into someone who I think my school friends thought were like, was the equivalent of Rod Stewart or Phil Collins in terms of like a sort of legend, but he was doing new music, which wasn't, you know, that's how White Noise had its moments, but I think Tin Machine for me was more reflective of the music that I was into, which is like Manic Street Preachers and so that sort of early Britpop.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it was in that, it was in guitar rock.
Guitar rock world. Yeah. But I mean, all right, yeah. I mean, I can,
different to Manic Street Preachers. But one
thing I felt about Tin Machine, which a lot of people have been talking about over the years, is the fact that they kind of predated the grunge movement. I mean, there's a story about how Tin Machine producer Tim Palmer was then 4 or 5 years later producing Pearl Jam.
Right.
And Reeves Gabrels happened to come down to the sessions one time and found they're all sitting around listening to Heavens in Here.
Right, yeah.
But that's interesting that you kind of, they fit into your map.
It was my time frame.
Yeah.
That was what I was listening to. I was listening to Manic Street Preachers, From Despair to Wear, and Tin Machine, and Faith No More. And just like, yeah, heavy rock and the Pixies. And it was all in the same world. And I think I was too young to really care about the fact that I didn't really understand that Tin Machine wasn't cool. It wasn't my concern. I was just into the music. And it was Heavens in Here, amazing. I really like Prisoner of Love.
That's a great one. Is that on the second one or this one?
It's on the first one.
It's on the first one?
Yeah.
It's got great twangy...
Oh, yeah, his guitar. Dang, dang, yeah. Dang, dang, dang. And his guitar in the choruses. It's sort of one-man guitar orchestra. Mm.
I always thought that reminded me a little bit of U2 and B.B. King.
Yeah.
When Love Comes to Town. There's something about it, you know, that sort of like Southern blues style.
Yeah.
Like echoey, tremolo-y guitar.
Yeah. And it's a bit, you know, it was supposed to be about his relationship with the younger dancer. And he's saying, you know, don't be corrupted, just stay square.
That was it, just stay square.
Yeah.
There's a lot of preaching on this album, isn't there?
There's a lot of preaching.
You know, like, don't take drugs, kids.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, yeah.
You know, like about video crime, whatever, you know.
But I guess actually in Day In, Day Out and all those, the videos.
Yeah, I mean, Day In, Day Out was his real social conscience.
Yeah.
Song. Political issues, social issues, race, drugs.
Yeah.
All the rest of it.
Yes, well, you know, social conscience, Dave. It's
social conscience.
Fine. Dave, yeah. By me.
So you're not a big fan of Bus Stop, because I think Bus Stop is actually one of my favourite songs in that album.
It just seems a bit, I don't know, it's another one of those, it's like, ugh, it's just like meat and potatoes, doesn't really go anywhere.
He's doing, for a start, he's doing his Anthony Newley, Cockney London voice.
Yeah.
The crime, da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And he's really hamming it up, and that's quite nice. And it's very short as well.
It's yeah.
It's, I feel you know, it's structured very well.
Yeah, there's a bit of injection of, yeah, there's a sense of humour to it to
it could
sort of
be,
balance
I mean, if,
out the
if
rest.
If I'm stretching this one a little bit more, it could be even something from his very early records.
Well, there are elements of Lodger in some of the stuff, because it's not like, not melodically driven. And I think there are songs on Lodger that are similar in the way that he sort of turns his back on melody, with the exception of Fantastic Voyage and the obvious ones. It's got that sort of more abstract. It's more about the mood rather than, it's not vocally, melodically driven. But some of the Tin Machine songs, I think, suffer from that, because they're just, it's just an assault.
Right, he's mixed quite low down.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not quite, very distinct.
That must be deliberate.
Yeah.
Because, it's just like Reeves Gabrels sort of wailing, and then Hunt Sales absolutely battering the drums. And a lot of the music, you can't even really hear what Tony Sales is playing. He's sort of very much drowned out. And then you get this other member, is it Kevin McDonald?
Kevin Armstrong,
who's like the rhythm guitar player, who was deemed not sort of not cool enough or interesting enough to be a part of the band.
You're not cool enough, Kevin. But Kevin Armstrong was playing on, he was part of the Live Aid band. And
he was on the live videos as well.
Was a second guitarist, I think, on Tin Machine when they toured, wasn't he? He was sort of a Craig Gannon figure that was just sort of like
beefing
up the sound.
And occasionally Bo would sort of wheel out his acoustic, but he was just not good enough.
No. But he said that in an interview. He just said, well, yeah, we got Kevin in because my acoustic isn't good.
The other song that I really like, I Can't Read. And it's interesting because he revisited that. I think it was like on a film, an Ang Lee film, The Ice Storm. He did he did like an acoustic version, and he always said that that was one of his favourite songs.
That's interesting, because that was something I wanted to ask you, was that what is the afterlife of this album? Because he never played these songs when he toured solo.
No.
And he would, I mean, I can't see them emerging anywhere else.
Well, so, you can't get Tin Machine 2. I mean,
deleted.
I have things to say about Tin Machine 2 as well.
Well, we'll have to say that in another podcast.
But there's some amazing songs on Tin Machine 2.
Yeah, I think Baby Universal, You Belong in Rock and Roll.
Brilliant. Yeah. There's some really great stuff, and but once again, it doesn't fulfill its potential. But, you know.
And that got really panned.
Oh, that got massively panned. Because it's interesting, as I was reading through reviews for this record, it didn't get badly reviewed. It wasn't the disaster that... Tin Machine 1.
Oh, Tin Machine 1 got good reviews.
Yeah, it wasn't the disaster that people thought it was. And I think people understood the intent behind it. Whereas I think by the time it got to Tin Machine 2, because there were some real stinkers on it, people by that stage were like, okay.
Plus he'd been out on the Sound of Vision tour. And he just spent a year, 2 years travelling around the world, playing all the greatest hits.
Yes.
I think he'd done one or two solo tracks here and there. People didn't want him to go back and do Tin Machine.
Yeah.
And so when he goes back and does Tin Machine, there was a sense of, oh, you've gone again.
Yeah, but the good thing about that is that EMI just...
Dumped him.
Yes, exactly. So he ended up, at the end of, after Tin Machine 2, it was all wrapped up and put to bed, and that was the end of that. But he was a completely free agent. And then he went on, he continued his collaboration with Reeves Gabrail, and went on to make, you know, some of my favourite albums, like Outside, Earthling.
Was Reeves on those two albums?
Reeves was on Outside, I think.
Say it again, but even hold it even longer. Outside.
Gonna have to look that up. Okay. It's in my book. Yes, no, they definitely... Well, they did the Hours record together as well.
Well, Hours, I don't know if we've talked about this, but Hours is really, I just find it so dull. It's like the Lighthouse Family. It's really...
Strangely dull.
I did, with David Quantic, I did a podcast about Hours, which obviously you've listened to.
uh-huh.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. This is what I say to all my friends. Like, oh, well, you've heard that podcast. And they're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Look what time it is. But Quantic met him when he was promoting Hours, and what he thought was funny was the fact he didn't want to talk about it at all. Like his record, he was on Virgin at that point, and Virgin flew Quantic over to New York to meet him. And he said that he was absolutely charming and very, very warm and welcoming and friendly. And he does this little trick with all journalists that you're the one he really wants to meet.
Yeah.
Which I've had as well in the past.
Right.
He's like, oh, God, I've just had half an hour with so-and-so from such and such a paper. God. Thank God you're here. So, of course,
amazing.
The journalists are all like,
oh, yeah.
And every time David Quantic tried to talk about Hours, he would just change the subject.
That's strange.
He'd talk about, you know, like 18th century Japanese etchings or
know,
sort of 1940s German expressionism, you know, something totally random.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't talk about the album, but I always thought the album was so dull.
It's the album it's the album I know the least, to be honest. I think by that stage, I had switched off.
We cut all this bit out, by the way. But
I need to look in my book.
What a bizarre thing that is, that Reeves, who was so avant-garde and so experimental and, you know, not afraid to kick up a racket with his guitar, ended his collaboration with Bowie on such a conventional album.
Yeah, it is strange. But Outside, well, I revisited Outside and Earthling, because I think at that point, I hadn't really, between like Black Tie, White Noise and Heathen, I got back onto it in Heathen era. And that's when Ash supported Bowie.
Right, yes.
Sort of reignited my love. And so I actually, after he died, I revisited Outside and Earthling, and and really think they're so good, and really got into the band that he had together supporting Nine Inch Nails.
Mm. So that was Gail Anderson.
Heaviness, Earl Slick.
Earl Slick.
The Irish.
Zach. Oh, yeah.
The Irish guitar player.
Hair.
Yeah.
And then was it Zach Orford, the drummer?
Yeah. And
was he the one that had
and Sterling
the famous
Campbell.
The story he told us last time?
That's Sterling Campbell.
That was Sterling Campbell.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Exactly. When he was going to do Always Questions.
Yeah.
And couldn't remember your name.
You forgot my name. Unbelievable.
How could he?
So, yes. So, to summarise, I think we can say that Tin Machine was a good thing. I don't think you can see it as a bad thing.
No, it was a very necessary thing.
It was a necessary process. And I think sometimes, you know, in music, you, or in any creative endeavour, sometimes you just got to go through something that is terrible to get to the good stuff. And, you know, there was... It's not all bad with Tin Machine. I think it's been... I do think it's been unfairly judged. If you go back to it and listen, there's good stuff. You can find good stuff, but there is quite a lot of bad stuff as well. But, you know, it's not a complete... it's not the complete travesty. And, you know, some of the reviews of the second record were absolutely brutal, like beyond...
Well, I do think that the first album is definitely superior to the second album.
The songs I like on the second album, I like a lot more than the first album.
Really?
So Amnapura, I think, is beautiful. Baby Universal. One Shot is interesting because that's actually produced by Hugh Padgham.
I was reading somewhere that the...
Poor Hugh
was brought in to make it more radio-friendly.
Yes.
And then Tin Machine retorted by just saying, well, there's nothing different in the Hugh Padgham mix, maybe a different hi-hat pattern, but that's
it's a pretty lame song. And he, you know, he's quoted as saying, you know, I just thought the sales brothers were completely nuts. And it was just all too hardcore for Hugh to handle.
But that's really what was credited with bringing down Tin Machine were... rumours of personal problems in the band. And Bowie himself said at some point, you know, I'd have liked to keep this thing going.
Yeah.
But there were problems in the band. You know, people talked about Hunt Sales' drug addiction at the time and things like that. I mean, and certainly there was a lot of tension between Sales Brothers and Reeves.
Yeah.
And it must have reached a point where it was actually untenable to carry on.
Yeah, I mean, he's quite tight-lipped about it, really. Bowie never said why they broke up. Mm. So... you can sort of guess, but nobody really knows. It just seemed like an experiment, like, you know, most of Bowie's career. It's just these are experiments. There was never any guarantee that it was going to last. Like, you know, the same old story for every other band member who's ever played with Bowie.
Once he's got what he needs, he moves on.
Yeah, that's it. And it's, you know, he absolutely got what he needed, which was... reinvention, a hardcore dose of reality of like what you've been doing is not working, and it broke him down to a point where he could actually move forwards, and led us to, you know, really amazing
Black Tie White Noise.
Black Tie White Noise. It's strange, isn't it, that would come before Outside.
He goes back to Nile Rodgers and he wants to do Let's Dance Part 2.
I think with Black Tie White Noise, so by the time he gets to Tin Machine 2, he'd met Iman and he was absolutely crazy, crazy in love. And that whole record, Black Tie White Noise, is a love letter.
It's a love song to her, isn't it? Yeah.
To Iman, and this sort of newfound happiness. So, you know, if all the middle age sort of divorcee anxiety that was hand in hand with Tin Machine. Sort of got cured. It's like he found himself and he found his muse and he probably felt sort of resurrected creatively.
Yeah.
He does this record, but then you get to the, like, back to basics with Eno and Outside and Earthling. And I think those two records have so much good stuff in it. And then eventually you get to the next day, Heathen. The next day and Black Star, but really good. I mean, Heathen less, Heathen's got some good stuff, but it's a little bit hand in hand with Hours for me. Back to that sort of quite classical
song. I see
songs.
A lot of space between Hours and Heathen. I think Heathen is a really different album to Hours.
Right.
I feel there's a lot more substance there. There's a lot more individuality. I mean, Visconti's back on board, and it's an album which was really crafted well, whereas Hours is just anesthetic.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
I guess I just mean in terms of, for me, nice songs really digging deep, whereas with The Next Day was just brilliant. I love that record.
To end with a hypothetical question, had Tim Machine continued, what do you think would have... do you think they'd have... I mean, I don't want to say got better, but do you think... How do you think that would have evolved? Do you think he'd have still pursued... might he have brought Eno into the mix? Might he have pursued a more esoteric direction?
I don't think the Searles Brothers would have allowed that. I think they very much had an agenda, which was as strong as Bowie's. And probably Reeves Gabrel, actually. He said that he was quite uncompromising in what he wanted. So all of them together, I cannot see it working.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Indeed.
Well, I mean, it's a frightening thought.
Indeed.
Who knows?
Who knows? Well, we'll leave it at that point. But Charlotte, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
And it's been an absolute pleasure to discuss Tim Machine and everything around it, and also your own record.
Someone had to do it.
Someone had to do it, and you nobly stepped up to the plate. And your record, True Love, is out at the moment, and it's an absolutely fantastic record.
Thank you.
It's well worth checking out. So from me, from Charlotte, and from Tim Machine, thank you and good night. I don't know why I did that ending.
Nice, it's very
well, and from me
woken.
And from Charlotte. And, it's a very nice one.
We are Reeves Gabrels, Tony Sayles, Pat Sayles, Eric Scummerhorn, David Bowie. We're Tim Machine. Thank you very much.
And that was me and Charlotte Hadley chewing the fat on Tin Machine. And I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. And I hope the sound of the aircraft and various squeaks and scrunks in the background didn't distract you too much. But we recorded it at the height of summer with the back doors wide open. Oh, summer. I'm missing it already. So, yes, that was Tin Machine. Please do let me know via Twitter or Facebook what you thought of the talk. If you've got any ideas yourself about Tin Machine, did you think it was all a colossal waste of time? Or did you generally agree with us that it was a worthwhile endeavour and one that wasn't at all wasted? So, yes, please do keep in touch. I'd love it if you could review, share, rate the podcast, all that kind of thing. It really, really does help. And do stay tuned, because now, after my little summer break, I'm back and we have more podcasts all ready to go. So thank you all for listening. Thank you all for the support, and see you soon.